call your mommy, your daddy, and all your friends and tell them New York's number one podcast app is blowing up the airwaves and they can't do nothing about it. Bashani Radio app. We global, baby.
Yeah, baby!
Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
You are now tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, author of the 12 Universal Laws of Success. I am your transformational speaker and trainer. We've written 8 books, had our books translated into many languages, but we are now engaged in transforming the lives of 10 million people, helping them be what they want to be, do what they want to do, and have whatever they want to have. If you would like to attract health, wealth, happiness, love, success, prosperity, and money into your life, you are in the right place. I would also like to thank our listeners for making the Millionaire Mentorship Show the number one new program on Bashani Radio with over 2.5 million listeners. With listeners like you, nothing is impossible. So keep up the good work. Keep on listening, sharing, and subscribing. I'd like to open our program today with a reading. We're doing something a little different. Another one of my books, Solving the Race Issue in America, has come to the forefront of a lot of the social and political and cultural changes that are taking place right now in our country. And I am really directed to chapter 12 of the book, which says, "Where do we go from here?" The question arises, does America have the moral authority to promote life, limb, and the pursuit of happiness to other people and countries when it still has not and cannot implement, promote, and guarantee those same inalienable rights to our own citizens, Black Americans? So as America dominates the world stage, it becomes absolutely necessary to resolve the spiritual and moral contradictions that undermine its international credibility. And this contradiction is involving the issue of racism. So today we have as a special guest, someone that I really, really love, my daughter, Olivia K. Harris. And she is a singer, songwriter, composer, all around good person, who loves to perform and sing and change the world. We have great conversations. Doing a show with your daughter is always funny because she's looking at you saying, "Dad, don't mess up." We'll get it right. So we have great conversations about really things of substance and things of importance. And so with all of the social activities going on as a result of the George Floyd murder, we have really began to refocus on our book, Solving the Race Issue in America, And by the way, it's available on Amazon and most places, most other bookstores, etc. But we want to focus on some of the different aspects of racism in America. So, Olivia, as a young person, as you see what's going on right now, what do you think about it? When you see young people coming together, making really a social statement, how does that inspire you? How does that make you feel?
First of all, I want to thank you for who you are. And many people know you as a leader. Many people know you as a coach, as a transformation trainer, as a, in a lot of capacities, but very few know you as in the capacity of father and the capacity of, a family member. And so first of all, I will say that, the things that I was taught as a child, which was always to think critically and to question what was in front of me, and to think on my feet, really pay attention to the world around me. And that's something that both of my parents very much advocated for. And so it's interesting because right now I feel like it's easier for me to believe that this is happening than I think it is for you. Mm-hmm. I feel like we've had a lot of conversations in the past few weeks where, you're kind of like shocked by the level of response around the world. You're like, oh my God, Australia and New Zealand and Paris and Berlin and, all these different places are protesting about Black America. And it is shocking, truthfully, it really is shocking for us to be so widely supported, physically, that people are demonstrating. But it also doesn't come as a surprise to me because I think just in the past 10 years, since I left high school, I entered college, working, living in New York City. In the past 10 years, I noticed the difference between when I graduated from high school and when I graduated from college. And then even now, there have been real differences in how people respond to people, especially Black people, but people of color and diversity in general. And I would say one of the really big turning points was the previous, the start of the Black Lives Matter movement. When I wrote my song Power in 2014, I wrote it at a time when people were not so interested or invested in a conversation about race. And my song was about race. It was about acknowledging the power that each and every one of us has, despite what other people may say or think about you. And it's not overt, but it definitely, it says, they say my people have no history, but how that's possible is a mystery. And that lyric goes, some of those lyrics are really about, I say outright, I'm here to take back my rights and enjoy my nights, save the whole world if it takes my whole life. And I think it's really, I am like many people in my generation, we're inspired by the generations of the past. And we see, like every young group of people, we see those injustices and we feel moved to action, So I'm actually not as surprised. I am sort of surprised at the domino effect of having a pandemic and then suddenly that is odd. But I will say that for me, this entire movement seems like it's about time. I just even the types of friends, the types of interracial interactions that I've seen mm-hmm. in the past 10 years has changed dramatically from just being a classmate, to being so that's what I would say.
Well, number one, folks, the song that you heard as we opened our program, that was Power. And that is Olivia and her group, the Parkers, performing that. And we also closed the show out with that. So, this is an incredible plug for your song that's available on iTunes and all those other digital platforms. And the video is available too, right?
That's right. It's on YouTube.
Beautiful. Well, Olivia, as you were sharing that, I understand what you're saying, because being an older person, I have seen these things happen before. And let's just, shall we say, peter out. You know, it's like it goes through one news cycle, maybe two. And if it's really egregious, you know, like Michael Brown or some of those other instances where unarmed black men were killed by policemen, it may go three news cycles, but never anything like this. I think we're on about, what, the 14th or 15th day? So this, from my perspective, is shocking, because it's the first time I've seen this type of social awareness, and not just awareness, but action, boots on the ground, feet in motion, that has sustained itself and kept going for so long. So, yeah, I think that's a big difference. This is probably your first real big rodeo. And I've seen so many small rodeos before that when the big rodeo came, I said, wow, this is interesting. But it is actually quite rewarding to see that the young people, and one of the things we point out in the book is all social change really happens with young people. When in the 60s, in the civil rights era there, the late 50s, early 60s, it was all about young people. The Greensboro Four were like 18-year-old. I think the oldest one was 19 and had just barely turned 18, okay? Many of the other marches were high school students. College seemed to be like the kind of the sweet spot, you know. Young people had just gotten away from home and got a chance to go out and experience the world, and they wanted to change it. They didn't like what they saw, and they wanted to change it. And so, young people have always been at the forefront, but I think this is the first time that literally I think these old fuddy-duddies are trying to catch up with you all. You know, in the 50s and the 60s, we worked to guide the young people. You know, Dr. King, there was actually a children's campaign. And one of the reasons was that children got the news cycle. Just to point out something, in our book, there's a chapter called Thank God for Television. And in the 50s and the 60s, if you didn't make the news cycle, if you didn't hit television, it was as though it didn't happen. And so with the younger generation, with not just the internet, but with access to the internet, and I call it unlimited access. See, in the 50s and the 60s, things happen, bad things happen, but if the news people didn't show up and film it, the world almost pretended that it didn't happen.
Right.
And I think that has made possibly some of us veterans a little cynical. You know, it's like, man, if you didn't make the TV, the 6 o'clock news, then as far as the world was concerned, it didn't happen, no matter how bad, how egregious it was. Mm-hmm. But now with you young people and the internet, you all are able to create your own news cycle. You are the news cycle. So
I think it's really interesting what you're bringing up because, well, I read something, I think, a couple of days ago. Firstly, you know, when Martin Luther King was, I think, giving his speech, his famous speech, he was 26.
Yes.
You know, when James Madison, this is like, you know, I love history, so I love history of all kinds. When James Madison was writing the Constitution and campaigning for the Constitution during, you know, after the Revolutionary War, he was 26.
Yeah.
He was 26 years old. And it's like, because I think part of it is, and I'm 27, so I can really relate. I think part of it is you've got a lot of energy and you've worked with people enough. You've been alive long enough to kind of know the system you're a part of, but you're not yet so entrenched in it that you feel like it's hopeless. And so you can really, there's so much mileage you can get out of someone who's both optimistic, hardworking, and willing to make a new plan, you know. And that's, I think, a big part of this is I think what is crazy for me, not so much having it, having the revolution and the the kind of intense protesting and all that, but more so how quickly this became extremely extreme.
Mm.
As in, and what I mean by that is the, you know, in my lifetime, I can remember being crying over like at least, you know, 10 black men dying, right? Abner Louima, Amadou Diallo. I remember going to school in eighth grade trying to talk about Amadou Diallo to the elite Upper East Side students who were like, I don't know what this is. And they were not interested. And they felt like I was, what I was saying was too much for them. So they like couldn't, they're like, why did she bring this song? It's about death. And it's about, you know, and I was like, this is what's happening in real life right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Now for our listeners, maybe they may not be familiar with Amadou Diallo. Maybe you could just tell a little background on that.
Well, I'm from New York. You know, I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and New York has a long history of police action that is extreme and uncalled for and, you know, honestly racist. And Amadou Diallo was a West African immigrant. I believe he was Senegalese, and this might have been, had to be like 2000, because I had to be around 10 or 11, maybe older, maybe a little older, but it was like 2000, 2001, some in the early 2000s. And he was murdered. He was shot 41 times by seven police officers who shot him 41 times because they believed they believed he was about to shoot them. He was a cab driver, as I recall. He was going inside his home on his doorstep, and they like kind of called at him, and he pulled out his wallet because he thought they wanted his ID, and they killed him.
Wow.
And it was the source of a huge uproar in the, kind of like you said, this is pre-internet. It was pre-social media. There was internet, but there was no social media. So it was New York having this thing, and then people who were connected to that, you know, people who were already politically connected heard about it, but it wasn't in your face. There was no video, you know, it was just like, we heard about it. But again, when you hear about something, you can kind of speculate like, oh, maybe that's not what happened. Or maybe he said this, or maybe, you know, like there's a lot of ambiguity that there isn't when you see a camera.
Yes. Well, and you know, that's a good point, Libby, because if it didn't get picked up in those days, if it didn't get picked up by the national news, then the rest of the world probably had no idea it had happened. And the news cycle was really controlled by the corporations. And so even though an event may have taken place, if the news people, if some reporter with a camera and a microphone didn't think it was no newsworthy, it never made it.
Or if their boss said no.
Yes.
Is that something that's come out, you know, in the story of, and this is going a lot of places, but I keep a good track of the cultural world in general, and you know, with Jeffrey Epstein, one of the things that came out in the documentary was that from the very beginning, he had an article about him in like Vanity Fair or New York Magazine or something. One of the like magazines like chronicling the lives of the rich and famous. And they had this spread about him because they were trying to figure out why did everyone know who he was and what was so interesting about him? Who was this man? They interviewed him. And one of the first things that came up to this reporter was that these two girls had accused him of molesting them. And she, the reporter, you know, wrote that, was ready to release that. And she got a cease and desist basically from her boss. And now of course, Vanity Fair denies that happened, but it's like, I mean, we know how that goes. Up until now, the power of media, the power of who gets to say what and when has been controlled by white men. And for the first time, it's in the hands of anybody else.
Now, Libby, I think that was a real breakthrough there because control, power and control is really what it's all about. And when the the news cycle, when the, as you say, white males have the authority to either let a story flow or put it under the rug. And so what the world saw was really controlled by a handful of people who decided what was newsworthy, or even more so, what was the reality that they wanted to project to the world. But with the internet and with young people, with everybody's a news person now. And with the internet, everybody's a news station, everybody's a TV station. And so now, with the young people and the technology, you have the ability to let the whole world know what you see in real time. That's a great amount of power. And I think that's why the powers that be are responding. So, you know, I've seen things happen that I never, you know, I've been pretty optimistic about the world, but I've seen things happen that I never thought would happen. But I think the powers that be are afraid now, because the power to define, that's really what this is, the power to define what is and to show what is in your hands, is in the hands of anybody with a camera, a telephone. You don't even have to have a camera now. Your telephone. That's awesome. Wow. Libby, we're really moving right along. We're right at the time now. You know, in New York, we used to call it, the pause for the cause. So let us take a little break to pause for the cause, and we'll be right back.
Ooh, yeah. I got the power. The power's in my hands. And you only wish that you could understand.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris, and I want to tell you about our new book. Our new book is called Solving the Race Issue in America, and it's by H.J. Harris. That is my pseudonym for writing social consciousness books. But this book will give you a history of racism in America. It will help you understand what has worked and what has not worked, and give you a spiritual solution. So go to www.solvingtheraceissue.com. That's www.solvingtheraceissue.com. And it'll tell you about our book, and you can click on it and get it on Amazon. The Kindle book is $3.99, and the paperback is $16.99. So be sure to get your copy of Solving the Race Issue in America by H.J. Harris. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, and you are tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show on Vishani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. All right. Folks, we're right back, continuing our discussion with my magnificent, incredibly smart, beautiful, sensitive, creative daughter. And we've been talking about racism in America and some of the differences between the civil rights era that I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and the civil rights era right now. A lot of what we're talking about was captured in our book, Solving the Race Issue in America. And it's very interesting, Libby. You remember I wrote an earlier version of this book, and the world really didn't receive it. You know, it was one of those kind of books that you sold 6 copies, and 5 of them were your friends and family.
5 of them you actually donated.
Thank you very much for that additional and further insight. And you know, in 2008, as a matter of fact, once President Obama was elected, everybody basically thought that the race issue was done once and for all, that there was really, that if, I think at that point, I think 56 million people voted for him. And I think that's the greatest number of votes of anybody ever running for president. And you figure, man, if black people and white people, and clearly what, there are only 30 million black people in America, and that's men, women, children, everything. So a lot of white people, millions of white people voted for him. So it really, on the surface, made us think that it was, the race issue was done. But as I think back, I remember like the next day after he was inaugurated, the Republicans had gotten together and basically made a statement that we will do everything in our power. And I mean, they were unabashed about it. They were like, we're going to do everything in our power to make him a one-term president. We're going to be obstructionists. We're going to fight his agenda at every turn, even things that we were in favor of before, we won't be in favor of them now just because it's coming from him. And that then I think that's when the call for taking our country back, the Tea Party. And it was amazing. It was almost like, well, was there a revolution? Did something happen? Did somebody invade the country that we didn't know about? Nobody told us. But that was the mindset, the kind of reactionary mindset to taking the presidency of President Barack Obama. Many times, well, Libby, let me ask you now, as a young person, what would you want to know from me, a person who's been around the block enough times to have created a sidewalk about the race issue?
I think what's always very interesting is the race issue always, it's always painful, but it also looks different to every person in every location and every, you know, like, so what is really special about our relationship and particularly your story to me is that you're one of the few people I know who lived during segregation, who's young enough to talk about it in a way that, like, you're still connected to what's happening right now, so you can, like, make parallels.
Yes.
You know, some people are like, not like you kids who use the phone, and you're like, oh, goodness. You know what I mean? But you're very much, you're a citizen of right now, mm-hmm. and you're also, like, someone who was very much there at that time. And, I think young black people, we think that this is the worst it's ever been. Like, or we know it's not. We know it's not the worst it's ever been, but we imagine this is just like, it is it's like, I can't even live. I can't even deal with it. And I guess what I'm curious about is, what were the habits of mind that people in your generation, including yourself, used to keep yourselves through these like incredibly traumatic experiences? Like I feel like my generation, we experience every trauma, and it's like you have a soft belly. Every mm-hmm. punch like really lands on everybody, and like, oh my God. And I mean, and like we've talked about, having technology, having the camera, having it in your face is different from hearing about it. Mm. Like seeing it over and over again it would be like being on the plantation, right? Like watching someone get murdered in front of you.
Yes.
And we're doing it, but we're doing it on a screen.
Wow.
And I think we're being inundated from all sides. And then we're watching other people comment about whether they think that's even happening or not. You know, like, oh, maybe, well, you didn't see the part before, you know, like all of those pieces. And it's very easy to get really stuck in mm-hmm. a frame of a paralysis of fear and a paralysis of, you know, this like disillusion, despair, you know, I can't take this on. It's too big.
Yes.
What what can you bring or teach us from those times of incredible, you know, yes. painful, terrible things, people dying, yes. but people getting, you know, beaten and eaten yes. by dogs and all that stuff.
Right. You know something, Olivia, as you were talking, when I was a kid in the late 50s, we did not believe that white people would be prosecuted for killing a black person. We did not believe that the law worked for us. And what's even worse, we accepted it. You know, and so as the civil rights era began to evolve, it was as though the young people, once again, me at that time was a young person, so we were carrying on that fight. But the people who were older at that time really did not believe that the justice system would work for you. And so our parents and our elders always gave us instructions of how to stay alive, that you really did not have recourse. And so one of the reasons for the nonviolent movement was that the white people had all the guns, and the police were an instrument of the racist mentality. And so many trials, you know, the people who bombed the church in Birmingham, the people who bombed the church in Birmingham literally confessed and they did, I think, a news article telling that they did it. And when they were tried, they still were not convicted. I remember doing some research, and one of the great politicians, at some point he was a judge, and there was a case where a black man had killed a white man who was breaking into his house or something, and the judge said, a black man just can't kill a white man. You just can't do that. I don't care what the circumstances are. When you have that kind of mindset, it's almost that we were taught that the elders would say that you have no recourse. So you better figure out a way to deal with this challenge that does not involve guns and violence. And I think it's out of that the nonviolent movement arose. But Dr. King had studied Gandhi, and there was really kind of the same situation in India. The British had all the guns. And so when Gandhi, who came, I think, from South Africa, when he began his evolution, his political evolution, he had to use nonviolence because they didn't have the guns. And so I think Dr. King set that model. But in the back of our minds was that idea that you don't have any recourse, that the police are not going to protect you. As the young people evolved and pushed us at that point, and I was a part of that we began with the civil rights era. We began to believe that the courts would protect you with the Brown versus the Board of Education. They had to send troops to integrate the schools, and James Meredith, they had to have the National Guard come. And so at that point, one of the takeaways from that era was that the government can work for you, that the courts can work for you, that the National Guard can work for you. The sense was that whatever the racism that was perpetrated on you, it was local. The hot button in those days was states' rights. It basically said states have the rights to do anything to black folks that they want to. And so, and that was really the context in which we lived. So the federal government came in to impose a structure that black people began to have confidence in. And I think that over the years that evolved, we had seen that, you know, from affirmative action and things that we thought would take us to the next level. But the original sin was never dealt with. And so the moment you had affirmative action, eventually you had the Bakke case where people sued to stop affirmative action. Where Everybody forgot what the reason was, or the assumption that, well, you've had it for 20 years, it should be okay now. We don't need it anymore. So meanwhile, your generation comes along and you have seen the benefit from affirmative action, but you've also developed a sense of justice and truth that is much more idealistic. In other words, when we got justice in the 50s and 60s, we were a little surprised. When you all get justice, you expect justice. And so I think one of the reasons that this movement is so powerful is that young people are saying, well, where's the justice? Where's the truth? That this whole thing presents a George Floyd and all the other terrible things presented a position to young people that said, this is not right. It shouldn't be done this way. And you're challenging the system now because the system has been perpetrating a lie. Libby, we're at a point in the show. You know we got to do some more shows, right? Did you have fun?
I did.
Well, let me do this. I like to keep our shows at a certain time. We've gone a little bit over. But I'll say to our listeners, we promise we're going to be doing a series. This is the first of a series, and that we want each and every one of you next week. This will be on Monday, and every Monday to be tuning in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show. Check out our Facebook page, and you're going to hear a series of talks between me and my daughter where we interpret and expose and share some of our own experiences with respect to this incredible social change that's happening in our country. Any last words, Olivia, for the young people or for the old people? Maybe you need to tell us what to do.
What I would say is, I think what for me is very important is that each and every one of us knows that one of the most important things is to be able to have hope. And as you said, to expect that what you want is coming. There is nothing more powerful than someone who moves confidently in what they want and demands that of the world. We'll have it. That's it.
Thank you so much, Olivia. For our listeners, tune in next week to another episode of the Millionaire Mentorship Show. Hey, folks, just a couple of reminders. Please go out and get a copy of our book, Solving the Race Issue in America by H.J. Harris, and you can go to www.solvingtheraceissue.com, read about the book, and click on the Amazon link to get the Kindle book or the paperback book, and check us out on Facebook. I'm going to close out now with a song that we wrote and performed that I think is very apropos for where we are right now. And it is called The Time to Love is Here.
Living a life that's empty, singing a song the sand makes you kind of wonder why everything seems so bad. So many sad faces gazing into space, waiting for somebody else to make the world a better place. Leave it up to the other man or to another day. If anything goes down, be looking the other way. I say, come on, everybody, come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubles, they be done. I tell you, come on, everybody, come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubled days be done. I'll
often sit and wonder how things could be this way. I guess we'd better tell them this is a brand new day. Don't leave it up to the other man or to another day. Take your life into your hands, make it work out your way. It's not the number of times you stumble down and fall upon the ground. It's the number of times you pick yourself up and keep on moving on to meet your goal. Come on, everybody. Come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubles may be done. I tell you, come on, everybody. Come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubled days be done.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris saying, you are tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show on Bishani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Vashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
The all-new Vashani Radio app. For iPhone and Android. You may be in quarantine, but you are not home alone.